You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collected works by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Bhagavad Gita and the West. It consists of two cycles of lectures, one the Bhagavad Gita and the Epistles of St. Paul, which is also found separately on this website, and that will now be included in this whole file for this one. And the second one, which I'm reading right now, I'm on lecture 4 of it, I'm about to read, is entitled The Occult Significance of the Bhagavad Gita, but this is also technically lecture 9 in this whole set, given in Helsinki on May 31st, 1913. We have seen that if one would enter into the realm to which, among other things, the woven fabric of our dreams belongs, one must take from the ordinary world something we described as an intensified self-consciousness. There must be a stronger and fuller life in the ego than one needs for one's purposes on the physical plane. In our age, this excess of self-consciousness is drawn forth from our soul by the experiences we gain through esoteric exercises such as I have given. Thus the first step consists in strengthening and intensifying one's inner self. Human beings instinctively feel that they need this strengthening, and if they have not yet attained it, a kind of fear and shyness comes over them. They tend to shrink from the prospect of experiencing higher worlds. We must continually bear in mind that in the course of evolution, the human soul has passed through many different stages. Thus, in the period of the Bhagavad Gita, it was not yet possible for a human soul to intensify its self-consciousness by such esoteric exercises as may be practiced today. In that ancient time, however, something else was still present in the self, namely primeval clairvoyance. This is also a faculty that humans do not really need for ordinary life on the physical plane, if we can be content with what our epoch offers us. But the people of that ancient time still had the remnants of primeval clairvoyance. So we can look far back and put ourselves in the place of a person living at the time when the Bhagavad Gita originated. Such a person would express his or her experience this way, quote, "When I look out into the world around me, I receive impressions through my senses. These impressions can be combined by the intellect, of which the brain is the organ. Apart from that, I still have another faculty, a clairvoyant power that enables me to acquire knowledge of other worlds. This power tells me that humanity belongs to other realms, that my human nature extends far beyond the ordinary physical world." Close quote. This very power, by means of which there arises in the soul the instinctive knowledge that it belongs not only to the physical world, is actually a stronger kind of self-consciousness. It is as though these last remnants of ancient clairvoyance still had the power to surcharge the soul with selfhood. Nowadays, humans can again develop in themselves such surplus forces if they will undergo the right esoteric exercises. Now, some objections may be made. You know that in anthroposophical lectures we must always forestall objections of which the true esotericist is well aware. Someone may ask, quote, "Why should it occur to present-day people to want to undertake esoteric exercises at all? Why shouldn't we be content with what our ordinary intellect offers us?" Close quote. That, my friends, is a big question, because it touches upon an actual fact for every thoughtful soul in the present cycle of evolution. If we did not reach out to anything more than what our senses and our brain-bound intellect can show us, we would certainly be content with our existence. We would observe the things and events around us, their relationships, and how they come into being and pass away again. But we would ask no questions about this ebb and flow of activity. We would be content with it, as an animal may be content with its existence. In fact, if humans were really the beings that materialistic thinking considers us to be, we could quite well accept our life as such and ask no questions. This is the life of the animal, content with all that arises and passes before its senses. Why isn't this the case with us? Remember that we are speaking of present-day humanity, for even in ancient Greece the human soul was different in this respect from what it is today. When we today give ourselves with our whole soul to the study of natural science, or when we consider all the events of historical evolution and gain a knowledge of the external science of history, with all this, something else finds its way almost imperceptibly into our soul, something that has no purpose nor any sense for physical life. Many comparisons have been made to illustrate this fact. I would like to mention one of them, because people often make use of it without considering its deeper significance. A famous medical authority in the last third of the 19th century, wishing to enhance the honor of pure science, once drew attention to the Greek philosopher Pythagoras, who was asked, quote, "What do you mean of philosophers who spend their time speculating on the meaning and purpose of life? How does their occupation compare with the activities of ordinary men who pursue some useful calling and play a useful part in community life?" Close quote. The philosopher replied, quote, "Look at a fair or market. People come to buy and sell, and everyone is busy. But there are a few among them who do not want to buy or sell, but simply want to stroll about and watch what is going on." Close quote. The philosopher implied that the market represented life, people busy in all sorts of ways, but the philosophers are not busy with such affairs. Instead, they look at what is happening and try to learn all about it. Somehow a great respect for philosophers has penetrated deeply into the minds of an intellectual humanity, precisely because philosophers do not obviously take part in any productive activity. The philosophers are honored just because their science is independent, detached, self-sufficient. Yet this comparison ought to give us food for thought, for it is by no means as banal as it might appear at first sight. After all, it is curious that philosophers should be compared to idlers in the marketplace of life, useless folk watching others labor. One might indeed think of it in this way, but we must realize that judgments are passed that originally are quite correct, but become altogether wrong if they linger on for centuries, or, as in this case, for thousands of years. Therefore we ask again, if these people who stroll about in life are really to be judged as idlers? That depends upon the standards by which we value human life. Certainly there are those who regard the philosophers as useless loiterers and think they would do better to perform some productive work. From their point of view, they may be quite right. But when we today observe life through the senses and consider it by means of the brain-bound intellect, something steals into the soul that obviously has no connection with the outer world of the senses. That is the point. This can be seen clearly in books that try to construct a satisfactory picture of the world and life on a purely materialistic basis. It usually turns out that the big questions do not arise until the end. The books claiming to solve the riddles of the universe actually only begin to set forth those riddles in their concluding pages. In effect, when one begins today to study the external world that is the subject treated in such books, the thought slips in that either humans exist for other worlds besides this world, or else the physical world deceives us and makes fools of us because it is continually raising questions for which we have no answer. If life really ends with death, if humans have no part in and no connection with a higher world, an enormous part of our soul life is meaningless. Indeed, it is not the longing for something we do not have, but the lack of understanding what we do have that impels us to follow up these questions and ask what it is that comes into the soul that does not belong to this world of the senses. Thus we are driven to cultivate something which is evidently without foundation in the external world. We are impelled to take up esoteric exercises. We would not say humankind has an inward longing for immortality and therefore invents the idea of it, but rather that the external world has implanted in our soul something that would be meaningless, unreal, if the whole of our existence were limited to the time between birth and death. Human beings are impelled to ask the nature of something they have, not of something they do not have. In fact, present-day humans are no longer quite in the position of mere loiterers or onlookers, so they cannot appeal now to the Greek philosopher. In those times the comparison held good, but today it does not. Today we might say that buyers and sellers come and go. When at length they close the market and make up accounts, they find something that certainly could neither have been bought nor sold, nor can they discover whence it came. That never happens in an ordinary market, but so it is in the market of life. Every comparison has its flaw, and this one is all the better for it. As we go on living, we are continually finding things that life opens to view, yet no explanation for them is to be found in the world of sense. That is the deeper reason for why there are people in the world today who despair of life, yet at the same time have vague, unrecognized longings. Something is active in them that does not belong to the physical world, but keeps on putting forth questions about other worlds. For this reason, we now have to acquire a spiritual culture. Otherwise, we shall be overcome by hopelessness and despair. What we now must acquire, someone like Arjuna, possessed simply because he lived in the ancient age of primeval clairvoyance. Yet it also was a period of transition, because he belonged to that time in evolution when only the last remnants and echoes of that clairvoyance remained. If we are to understand the Bhagavad Gita, it is important to realize that at the time of its appearance, humans were entering an age in which this old clairvoyance gradually became lost. In this lies the deep undercurrent of that sublime poem, or, we may say, the source of the breath poured out through it. For this song resounds with tones of a great turning point in time, when from the twilight of the old clairvoyance a night was to begin in which a new force could be born to humankind. Only in that night could a force be born that the soul of today possesses, but which souls of that time did not yet possess. About Arjuna, then, we can say that ancient clairvoyance is still present in his soul, but it is flickering out. It is no longer a strong, spontaneous force. Rather, it requires a harrowing experience, such as I have described, to reawaken it. What then can Arjuna perceive through this awakening of the ancient power of vision, which at other times was dying away within him? He sees the spiritual being called Krishna. Here it is necessary to point out that though humans may lift their souls today into that realm where dreams are woven, this is no longer enough to give a full understanding of Krishna's being. Even if we develop the forces enabling us to consciously pass into the region of dream consciousness, we still are unable today to fully discover what Krishna is. Referring again to what I said yesterday, let us call our everyday consciousness the lowest realm. Above it lies a realm of which we are unconscious in daily life. Or, rather, a world that becomes conscious only in a kind of illusory image as Maya or dream consciousness. But when we, so to speak, wipe out the dreams, erase the Maya, then impressions from another world enter this region of human consciousness. Into all the experiences we have of our physical environment, something now enters that is like a kind of overflow in the soul, and really belongs to other worlds, to inner supersensible worlds. Now we have an experience that cannot be described as a reminiscence of ordinary life. The world now has a different aspect from anything known on the physical plane. We discover that we are seeing something we do not see in the ordinary world. Though we often imagine that we see light, in reality it is not so. On the physical plane we never see light, only color, and different shades of color, darker and lighter colors. We see the effects of light, but light itself speeds invisibly through space. We can easily convince ourselves of this fact. When a ray of light strikes through the window, we see a kind of streak of light rays in the room caused by dust in the air. We see reflections of light from the glittering particles of dust, the light itself remaining invisible. After lifting our experience to the higher realm we have spoken of, we really do begin to see the light itself. There we are surrounded by flowing light, just as in the physical world we live in flowing air. Only we do not enter this world with a physical body. We have no need to breathe there. One enters that world with a part of one's being that needs light, as in the physical world one's body needs air. In this region, light is the element of life. Light air, we might call it, and it is a necessity for existence. Further, that light is permeated and transfused with something not unlike the cloud forms shaping and reshaping in our atmosphere. The clouds are water, but up there what meets us like floating forms is nothing other than the weaving life of sound, the music of the spheres. Still further we shall perceive the flowing of life itself. Thus we may begin to describe the world into which our souls enter, but the terms of our description must remain meaningless for the physical world. Perhaps those who use words most lacking in meaning for the physical world will best describe that other world that has a far higher reality. Of course, our materialistically minded friends will find it easy to object to these ideas. Their arguments against what the esotericist has to say are plausible enough. The esotericist knows how easily such objections are made, for the very reason that the higher worlds are best described by words not suitable for things of the physical plane. For example, the esotericist would speak of light air or air light. On the physical plane there is no such thing, but over there, there is. Indeed, when we penetrate into that realm, we also discover what is to be deprived of this life element, to have insufficient light air. We feel the pain of suffocation in our soul, comparable to losing our breath for lack of air on the physical plane. There we also find the opposite condition, a fullness of pure, holy, light air in which we can live and perceive spiritual beings that live there too, manifesting themselves in full clearness. Those are the beings who stand under Lucifer's guidance. The moment we enter that realm without sufficient preparation, without proper training, Lucifer gains the power to deprive us of the light air we need. We can say that he suffocates our souls. The effect is not quite the same as suffocation on the physical plane, but like a polar bear transported south, we thirst and long for something that can reach us from the spiritual treasure, the spiritual light of the physical plane. That is just what Lucifer desires, for then we do not pay attention to all that comes from the upper hierarchies, but thirstily cleave to all that Lucifer has brought onto the physical plane. This is what happens if we have insufficiently trained ourselves in preparation. Then, when we stand before Lucifer, he takes the light air away from us. We crave breath and long for the spiritual that comes from the physical plane. Let us suppose that a person goes through a training that brings him far enough to enter the higher worlds, to reach this upper region. But suppose he has not done all that belongs to the training. Suppose he has forgotten that with all his exercises, he must at the same time be ennobling his moral sense, his moral feelings. Suppose that he must let go of all earthly ambitions and all lust for power in his soul. Indeed, one can reach the higher worlds even if he is vain and ambitious, but he takes these qualities with him. When a person has not purified his moral feelings, Lucifer takes the light air away from him, so that he perceives nothing of what is really there, and instead he longs for things on the physical plane. He breathes in, so to speak, what he has been able to perceive on the physical plane. So he may imagine that he perceives something, only to be seen spiritually in the light air. He imagines that he sees the different incarnations of various human beings, but it is not so. He does not see them, because he lacks the air light. Instead, like a thirsty being, he sucks up into that realm things of the physical plane below, and describes all manner of things acquired there as though they were processes in the higher region. There is no more harmful way of raising one's soul into the higher worlds than by means of vain and earthly love of power. If one does this, one will forever remain unable to bring down true results of cognition. What one brings will be mere reflections, a phantom picture of the speculations and conjectures one may have made in the physical world. We have been describing what might be called the general scenery of that realm. There are also beings we meet there, whom we may call elemental beings. In the physical world, we often speak of forces of nature. In that higher realm, these forces manifest themselves as real beings. There, we make a definite discovery. Through the actual facts that meet us, we discover that whereas, on the physical plane, good and evil exist together, in that higher realm there are separate, specific forces of good and evil. Here in the physical world, good and evil are combined and interwoven in each human soul. One has more of a tendency to good, another less. In that realm, there are evil beings who exist to battle against the work of good beings. Consequently, on entering that realm, we already have occasion to make use of the strengthened self-consciousness we mentioned yesterday. We have need of the more acute power of judgment that must come with our enhanced self. Then we may really be in a position to say that here in the higher realm there must be beings who have the mission of evil. Such beings have to exist alongside those who have the mission of good. We often hear it asked, quote, "Why didn't the all-wise God of the universe simply create the good alone? Why isn't it everywhere always?" Close quote. Now we gain this conviction, however, that if only the good were present, the world would become one-sided. It would not bring forth all the fullness of life that it does yield. The good must have something to oppose it. This, in fact, can already be realized on the physical plane, but in that higher realm we perceive it with far greater force. There we see that only people who are content with a merely sentimental and dreamy outlook can imagine that good beings alone could bring about the purposes of the universe. In the realm of everyday life we might do with sentimentality, but we cannot tolerate it when we enter the stern realities of the supersensible world. There we know that the good beings alone could not have made the world. They would be too weak to mold this universe. In the totality of evolution, those forces must be included which come from the evil beings. There is great wisdom in this fact that evil is mingled in cosmic evolution. Thus we have to get rid of sentimentality when we enter spiritual life. Bravely and unflinchingly, we must approach the dangerous truths that dawn upon us when we perceive the battle that is fought in just this realm, the battle between the good and evil beings that can there be revealed to us. All these are experiences we have when we have trained and adapted our souls to enter consciously into this realm. So far, we have only entered the realm of dreams. We human beings live in still another realm, one for which we are so little adapted in ordinary life that we generally have no perceptions whatsoever of it. It is the realm through which we live in dreamless sleep. Here an absolute paradox appears, for sleep, after all, is characterized by the complete cessation of consciousness. In normal human life today, people cease to be conscious when they fall asleep, and they do not regain consciousness until they wake up again. In the age of primeval clairvoyance, this realm too was something the soul could experience. If we go back into those ancient periods of evolution, however, there was actually a condition of life, corresponding to our sleep, in which people could perceive in a still higher, still more spiritual world than the world of dreams. This was true even in early post-Atlantean times. There we find conditions that, in regard to the usual human processes, are exactly like the condition of sleep, but are not, because they are permeated by consciousness. When we have reached this height, we do not see the physical world, even though we still see the world of light, air, of sound, of cosmic harmony, and of the battle between the good and evil beings. The world we see may be said to be still more fundamentally different than what I have described so far from all that exists in the physical world. So it is yet more difficult to describe than the world we find on entering the region of dream consciousness. I would like now to give you an idea of how one's consciousness in this realm works and of its actual effects. Anyone who describes that sublime world into which our dreams find their way, and about which I have given the merest hint, will be labeled a fantastic visionary by the prejudiced intellectualism of today. If anyone begins to speak of that still higher realm through which the human being ordinarily sleeps, then people, if they take any notice at all, will not stop at abusing that person as a visionary. They altogether lose their heads. We have already had an example of this. When my books were first published in Germany, the critics who were supposed to represent the intellectual culture of today attacked them with all sorts of insinuations. In one point, however, their criticism ran absolutely wild. In fact, they became foolish in their fury to the point where I had to call attention to something that could only originate in the spiritual realm we are now considering. This was the question of the two Jesus children mentioned in my book titled The Spiritual Guidance of the Individual and Humanity. For those of our friends who have not heard of this, I may say once more that it appeared as a result of esoteric research, namely that at the beginning of our era, not one but two Jesus children were born. One was descended from the so-called Nathan line of the house of David, the other from the Solomon line. These two children grew up side by side. In the body of the Solomon child lived the soul of Zarathustra. In the 12th year of the child's life, this soul passed over into the other Jesus child, and lived in that body until its 30th year. Here we have a matter of the deepest significance. Zarathustra's soul went on living in the body that until its 12th year had been occupied by a mysterious soul. And then only from the 30th year onward, there lived in this body the being whom we call the Christ, who remained on earth altogether for 3 years. We really cannot take amiss the critics' reaction to this statement. It is natural that they should want to have something to say about the matter from their scholarly viewpoint. But what they set out to criticize comes from a realm in which they are always fast asleep. So we cannot expect them to know anything about it. Yet a healthy human understanding is able to grasp this fact. When people do not give themselves a chance to understand, in their haste, they change their powers of understanding into bitterness and fury. Such truths as these about the two Jesus children, which are to be found in this higher realm, never have anything to do with sympathy and antipathy, we find such truths. We never experience them in the way we gain experience in the usual manner of knowledge in the physical world, or even in the realm of dream life. In both these areas, we are there, so to speak. We are present at the origin of our knowing or perception. This is true also of those esotericists who are conscious only as far as the realm of dreams. We can say that a person witnesses the birth of his or her knowledge, of his or her perceptions in that realm. But truths like this concerning the two Jesus children can never be found in this way. When truths come to us in that higher realm and enter our consciousness, the moment in which we actually acquired them has long since passed. We experienced them long before we met them with our full consciousness, as we have to do in our time. We have them already in us, so that when we reach these truths, the most important, the most living and essential of all truths, we distinctly have the feeling that when we gained them, we were in an earlier time than the present, that we are now drawing out of the depths of our soul what we acquired in an earlier time, and are bringing it into our consciousness. Such truths we discover in ourselves, just as in the outer world we come across a flower or any other object. Even as in the outer world we can think about an object that is simply there before us, so can we think about these truths in this way when we have discovered them in ourselves, in our own self. In the outer world we can only judge an object after we have perceived it. In the same way we find those sublime truths objectively in ourselves, and only then do we study them in ourselves. We inwardly investigate them as we would investigate the external facts of nature. Just as it would have no meaning to ask of a flower whether it is true or false, there would be no sense in asking of these truths that we simply come upon in ourselves whether they are true or false. Truth and falsehood only come into the picture when it is a question of our power to describe what we find or what arises in our consciousness. Descriptions can be true or false. Truth and falsehood do not concern the facts. They concern the manner in which any thinking being approaches or deals with those facts. When we do research and get results in this realm, we are really looking into a region of the soul we have lived in before, but did not look there consciously. In carrying on our esoteric exercises, we are best able to enter this realm if we pay positive attention to those moments when from the depths of our soul arise not mere judgments but facts, facts that we know we did not consciously take part in originating. The more we are able to wonder at the things there unveiled, as with the objective things of the outer world, the more astonishing it all is for us, and the better we are prepared to enter into this realm. So as a general rule, we do not make a good entrance if we have all sorts of conjectures and constructions in our minds. For example, there is no better way of finding nothing at all about the previous incarnations of some person than to speculate as to who they might have been earlier. Let us say you wanted to investigate the earlier incarnations of Robespierre. The best way of finding out nothing at all about him would be to search about for historical personalities you think might possibly have been his previous incarnations. In that way you never can discover the truth. You must get out of the habit of making conjectures and theories and forming opinions. Those who would become true esotericists should set themselves to making as few judgments as possible about the world. In that way they will most quickly attain the condition in which the facts can meet them. The more you cultivate silence in your conjectures and opinions, the more your soul will be filled with the actual truths of the spiritual world. Someone, for example, who had grown up with a particular religious bias, with definite feelings and ideas, or perhaps views about the Christ, such a person in general would not be the most adapted to discover a truth like the history of the two Jesus children. Only when one feels a little bit neutral about the Christ event is one well prepared for such a discovery, provided, of course, one has made all the other necessary preparations. People with a Buddhist bias will least be able to talk sense about Buddha, just as those with a Christian bias will least be able to talk sense about Christ. This is always true. If we would enter the third realm just described, it is necessary that we go through all the bitterness, for in ordinary life we cannot help feeling this way, of becoming, so to say, a twofold person. We are, in fact, twofold beings in ordinary life, even if we make no conscious use of half of our existence, for we are both waking and sleeping beings. Different as these two conditions are, so is that third realm in the higher worlds different from this physical world. That realm has a peculiar existence of its own. There also we are surrounded by a world, but one so altogether new and different that we get to know it best if we extinguish not only the sense impressions of this world of ours, but even our feelings and sentiments, and all the things that have the power to arouse our passions and enthusiasms. In ordinary life, one is so little fitted for conscious experience of that higher world that one's consciousness is extinguished every night. One can only attain experience there if one can become a twofold person. Those who have the power, at will, to forget and to blot out all their interests in this physical world are then able to enter that higher realm. The world between, that is to say, where our dreams are woven, is made of the materials of both worlds. It is penetrated by reflections of the higher worlds of which we are generally not aware, and by reminiscences of ordinary consciousness. That is why no one can perceive the true causes of events in the physical world who is not able to penetrate with understanding into that third realm. Now, if people today wish to discover through their own experience who Krishna is, they can only make that discovery in the third realm. Arjuna's impressions, which in the sublime Gita are described to us through the words of Krishna, have their origin in that world. For this reason, I have had to prepare the way today by speaking of humanity's ascent into the third realm. Only through this knowledge will you be able to understand the origin of the strange and wondrous truths that Krishna speaks to Arjuna, truths that sound so altogether different from anything that is spoken in ordinary life. These lectures are to help us gain knowledge of Krishna, that is to say, of the very essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Also, the esoteric principles of this wonderful song are to give you something that, if you really make use of it, can enable you to find your way into the higher worlds, because the way is open to every human being. We have only to realize that the grain of gold with which we must begin is ours, once we become aware of the many ways in which the highest spiritual beings live and work and are interwoven in our everyday life. The end of Lecture 9.